Think Tank 8, which was my own, and which was the one looking at the clinical utility of urodynamics. And Ruud Bosch has gone, but Hashim is going to present on our behalf.
Okay, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'll present the findings from Think Tank 8, which basically looked at constructing trials to show that urodynamics is not necessary in lower urinary tract dysfunction. And there were six of us who looked at the Think Tank and divided ourselves into men and women. Basically myself and Matthias look at LUTS in men, essentially OAB and bladder outflow obstruction, and then Linda Dudley and Paul Hilton looked at the female part. What we looked at is, urodynamics. Why shouldn't we be doing them? Initially, the disadvantages of urodynamics, and basically they could be thought of as time-consuming. They are expensive. I think someone mentioned that in the U.S. they're about $1,500. They need special training in urodynamics, and we need good quality urodynamics. It's very important, and obviously it has morbidity. There's about 2 to 3% chance of infections, and there is limited objective evidence for the clinical utility of urodynamics in terms of outcome, clinical decision making, and cost effectiveness. And this will come out in the presentation as well. In 2005, Derek Griffiths looked at a question which was felt was very important here, is that if urodynamics have limited effect on outcome or decision-making, then it is not important really to understand how the urinary tract works in order to treat it with current methods. And there are four possible explanations for this. The first one is that all patients have similar pathophysiology. However, this is probably unlikely because urodynamics does not improve the classification of patients into the different categories. The second explanation was that urodynamics does not address important pathophysiological differences. And this could be, the result of this is that we're doing the wrong tests on the patients. And this may well be true, and therefore urodynamics would not be enough and we would need more tests. The third explanation would be that we do the right tests, but we're doing them poorly, and this obviously comes out doing urodynamics not up to the ICS standards, and this would give us unreliable results, and this is also a possible explanation. And the final explanation is that current treatments are not specific, and therefore the underlying dysfunction would not be important, and this may be a correct explanation. So we looked at the title of the talk, which was urodynamics was unnecessary, and we thought that we shouldn't be calling that, and that urodynamics, we shouldn't be using unnecessary. We shouldn't show that urodynamics are necessary, but what we should look at is that whether urodynamics are necessary in the five conditions that we looked at, and evaluate the clinical utility of urodynamics. So studies to prove that urodynamics are not necessary are problematic because we don't have something to compare urodynamics to. There is no gold diagnostic standard. Urodynamics is supposed to be the gold standard. We need a very large sample size to get equivalence data. If we just wanted to show a 10% improvement in outcome, then we need 400 patients in each arm. So you can imagine that if we wanted to prove equivalence, we need much more patients. And also, in which clinical scenarios do we consider urodynamics necessary? The design of the studies, we need to design studies in these particular scenarios. So how to do these studies and why? Well, is it possible to do these studies as a standalone, so each center doing their own thing, or do we have to work together or with industry? So we divide this table to look at what we need to do, look for in trials, and basically dividing it into the five categories which we've discussed and looked at the primary outcome measure, the sample size, and how to implement it. But we haven't filled out this table. We left it for discussion. So I'm just going to discuss each of the presentations briefly. When we discussed LUTs and BPO, there was a discussion on using alternative methods such as bladder wall thickness and detrusor wall thickness as an alternative to invasive urodynamics. And the data presented showed that bladder wall thickness and pressure flow studies are equal in showing obstruction using ROC curves with a 0.94 correlation. But now, if we assume that this is correct and we use bladder wall thickness, then how do we go ahead and do clinical utility studies on bladder wall thickness? And also, what about DO, which has to be diagnosed with urodynamics? So if you're doing urodynamics, we might as well do the pressure flow studies at the same time. So this we sort of had a discussion about this. Then we looked at incontinence in men and women, and essentially the data shows that, you know, in men who have incontinence, we've got 90% correlation between symptoms and predicting detrusor overactivity. So do we really need urodynamics to prove that someone who's a man who's leaking, that do they really need urodynamics? But in women, the correlation is lessened because women have stress urinary incontinence. So then we looked at more specifically the LUTs in OAB in men, and the National Institute of Clinical Excellence in the UK published their report about a month ago, and they asked this specific question, and that in men with LUTs, what is the effectiveness of performing multi-channel cytometry tests versus not performing the diagnostic test? And what was interesting is that there was no clinical studies were identified to answer this question, and no economic studies. And this was similar to the ICI conclusion in 2008. However, what they recommended is that using clinical judgment, we should be doing cytometry on patients. And this obviously got a big debate going on. And their conclusion is, why are we doing it if there's no evidence? Well, it's an expert opinion, level 5 evidence. The clinical benefit of doing cytometry is that a diagnosis of LUTs can be established, and information is that it provides could be important because it could reduce the cost of unnecessary surgery, and that's why it's been recommended. Then we looked at OAB and DO in women, and what the discussion showed that we need to be to standardize basically good urodynamic practice and perform it carefully. We need to find out which tests we do and for which patient. Urodynamics is not the same in clinical practice as in clinical trials because they're more controlled in clinical trials. Ambulatory urodynamics may offer a more physiological approach, but currently has more associated problems. It's a longer test. Patients may not like it, and it's could be more costly. We presume that OAB is due to DO, but this is not often the case, as I've showed you on the data. And whilst urodynamics may improve the outcome of management of OAB, do they provide additional useful information that will affect outcome? So these are all questions that actually came out of the session. Then we looked at stress urinary incontinence and urodynamic stress incontinence in women, and the Cochrane reviews showed that there's only 3 trials with 128 participants, so really not enough data to determine if urodynamics has clinical outcomes. There is a trial which is going to be ongoing in the UK from Newcastle with a multi-center trial, and it's a pragmatic trial looking at basically invasive evaluation before any surgical treatment for incontinence, and it's a randomized trial. One trial is about to finish recruitment in the Netherlands. The first part of the trial actually was terminated because they couldn't recruit, but they have started recruiting and they're about to finish, and we will look forward to hear the results of this trial. And then there's another trial in the US which has completed recruitment, and we're waiting to see the results of that as well. So there are trials undergoing in stress urinary incontinence. As far as prolapse is concerned, there is occult urodynamic stress incontinence in about 25 to 50% of prolapse patients. So it is important to reduce the prolapse before doing urodynamics. But you get the pessary, and that can be done using pessaries, which give you a positive test in 50% and a false positive in 72 cases. And therefore, pre-urodynamic studies may not be effective. However, there is no studies to assess the reproducibility or technique. And the ICI looked at this and concluded that there's level one evidence that stress incontinence may occur following surgery. We need to standardize the methods revealing occult stress incontinence, and concomitant procedures to prevent stress incontinence following prolapse surgery are not reliable. And there's a grade B recommendations that patients should be informed about the relative unpredictability of developing stress incontinence. So in summary, really, we decided not to look at studies showing that urodynamics are unnecessary, but what we really need to do is to look at whether they are necessary in patients, whether they're necessary because the clinician thinks they're necessary, look at the outcomes, whether they're going to affect treatment, and also in the decision-making, and also looking at the clinical utility of urodynamics. Thank you very much.
We had quite a lively think tank and a lot of contributors, and I think it really went very well. I'm sorry that Ruud isn't here. So any questions or comments about the way we've restructured this? Yes, Paul.
I think your conclusions sound right to me, that nobody has ever suggested that you can study lower urinary tract function by any test other than urodynamics.
That's correct.
Therefore, it's counterintuitive that urodynamics aren't helpful.
Yeah,
and therefore I'm sure that, you know, you're saying that one of the major problems, and we all know, all of us who have taught urodynamics know that there's a huge problem with the way that urodynamics are carried out. The difficulty I have is that if you're going to do a trial, that the people that know about lower urinary tract dysfunction are going to be able to relatively well manage without them. People who don't know much about lower urinary tract function aren't going to be able to do the urodynamics well, and are also probably going to select the patients badly because they don't know much about the subject. So the actual construction of a trial around whether urodynamics is useful, I think, is really, really hard, because you can't get an equal group of clinicians to participate who are equally good with and without urodynamics and equally experienced in looking after lower urinary tract dysfunction.
Yeah, constructing trials is quite difficult. John Hesikas might want to say something about it, because they've got a trial ongoing in the Netherlands. But it was very interesting that in the trial that they've just finished recruiting for in the US, they only had to have 270 patients in each arm, whereas the trial that Paul Hilton has constructed in Newcastle upon Tyne, the suggestion was that it was a minimum of 3,000 patients that would be required to give an answer. And I think one of the problems here is that we're looking at improving the outcome of an intervention using a diagnostic test. And that's really very difficult to do, and it's an awful lot to ask of the diagnostic test. I mean, investigations such as urodynamics are not only used to improve outcome, they're used to diagnose underlying pathology and to alter your clinical decision, and that's really completely different. John, do you want to say a little bit about your trial that's ongoing?
Yes. The trial we're running now and is nearly finished is in 600 patients, and it's done in 20 centers, and you're completely right. The quality of the urodynamics done in those centers will vary a lot. So one of the activities we do as well is that we look at all the urodynamics that were done in this trial by expert urodynamicists and see what they get out of it, compare it to the result which was put into the trial by the ones who did it, and see whether there's a big difference there, and see whether it is really garbage in, garbage out.
Of course, one of the problems with that is that if you're not present at the urodynamics, you don't know whether it's reproduced the patient's symptoms. I mean, central reading doesn't really work. It only works at reading the graph. It doesn't work at interpreting.
Yes, but as you also know, Linda, is that in clinical practice, a lot of people say we don't need the urodynamic because we cannot get any information out. So real life says that it's useless, as a lot of people say. So we want to see whether that's true and whether it's because there is no information in it or whether it's because the urodynamics were done wrong.
And your trial is done in men and women?
No, only women.
Only women undergoing surgery?
That are intended to undergo surgery for stress incontinence.
And your primary
surgery.
And your primary outcome measure is?
Is an improvement in UDI-6 and the difference between the group that had urodynamics, that had a discordant urodynamic as compared to the clinical symptoms, and the ones that had a concordant urodynamics as compared to the clinical symptoms.
You see, I think it would be quite hard to prove that your quality of life had been improved more or less by having an additional test. I think that's quite difficult. I don't know what you use, but that's what I'm trying to explain, that to actually improve outcome with a diagnostic test must be almost impossible.
Yes, but you can look at the urodynamics from a diagnostic point of view, saying, okay, is it real stress incontinence and to what extent, or you can look at disturbing symptoms like DO or low bladder capacity, etc., and see what whether that combination affects the outcome. So, of course, it can be done always better, but we need to start somewhere to see whether it really is something which is meaningful for having a surgical decision.
No, I mean, I think it's very useful that these trials are ongoing. Any other questions or comments? Well, thank you very much. And we're going to...